It's an art and a craft that has its roots deep into prehistory. Today, as part of our Food Friday series, we're going to talk about butchering, what it means, how it's done, and why how it's done matters. Our guests are Ryan Fibiger, owner and head butcher at Craft Butchery in Westport, Connecticut, which exclusively carries humanely raised, pasture-raised meat from small local farms, and Sam Garwin, a butcher at Kraft, who also works to educate the public about using the whole animal. And we invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation. You can give us a call at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at wnyc.org. You can also join in on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And Ryan, have I been pronouncing your last name correctly?
Pretty close. It's Fibiger.
Fibiger. Okay. Well, yeah. I won't make that mistake again. what's the definition of butchering, or is it butchery, and is there a difference?
No, I wouldn't say that there's a big difference between the two. We use the term butchery in the name of our company. It's kind of a throwback to kind of the old French word, boucherie. But in general, I wouldn't say there's a difference in butchering being done at a butchery might be one way to define it.
Do we know how long after Homo sapiens started walking the earth that they began butchering meat?
I don't have the exact time frame, but I got to imagine it's one of the first forms that they began using. As soon as they were able to bring down the animals, it had to be dealt with pretty immediately.
And at the beginning, they were eating the meat raw, so they probably the butchering methods were a little different because you have to learn how to cut in a way that's going to keep the meat relatively tender, don't you?
Yeah. It'd be really interesting to see what those methods might have been, because you're right, before that they were using flames to cook it, which is going to bring on, actually help digest it and make it more tender. There would have had to have been a lot of technique involved in actually, bringing those cuts out that would have actually been somewhat edible, especially for the type of animals they would have been eating at the time as well.
Now, what about today? What kind of training is required, Sam, to become a butcher? Are there school courses, Cutting Beef 101?
That's a great question. The education resources right now are actually pretty limited, and there are some people who are working right now to try to make a butchery school that you could attend if you wanted to be a butcher. But right now, your options are pretty much limited to apprenticing for a butcher shop that is currently in existence, like Saugatuck Craft Butchery or some of the other kind of new school butchers that are popping up. And by an apprenticeship, I just mean basically working for free. So you show up and you say, I want to learn. And the best way to learn is to get hands-on. And you have to learn the anatomy. You have to do the techniques over and over and over again, and through that repetition you learn.
And I actually tried my hand at cutting some meat once when I had a television show, and they filmed me in a butcher department, and it looked so easy, and they stopped me before I went very far because that carcass was expensive and they didn't want me to totally mess it up. How long before you were trusted with a piece of meat, Sam?
Well, you start off with very easy things or very inexpensive things. So the first thing that we do with our apprentices is, just removing the bones from things. So you'll get a lamb neck, which is, has vertebrae in it that are kind of intricate, and it just gets you used to using a knife. It gets you trained on the anatomy, but you're not going to be messing anything up if you make an error. So you work from those easy or less expensive pieces up to larger ones. And we actually offer hands-on butchery classes for anyone to come in and try their hand at it. And that's always an interesting experience because it's very different knife skills than, say, cutting up vegetables or something like that in your kitchen.
Well, is it just a matter of having knife skills? Because, and I throw this out to both of you, because I understand that just based on supermarket meat at times, one butcher will be more skilled than another, and the same cut of meat from the same supplier will either be fabulous or really tough.
Yeah, I think it's a lot more than just knife skills. You know, there is certainly, you mentioned at the beginning of the show, there's certainly an art form to it, and you can kind of see that. I've seen a lot of students develop into, you know, great butchers and mediocre butchers and poor butchers, and, you know, it's more than just kind of having a knife in your hand, and I think the only way to learn is to do it, is to have hands-on with the meat in front of you. There's no way to learn this stuff just from a textbook. You have to do it repeatedly every day, and it's a muscle memory thing. You'll see, you know, great examples of great chefs who, you know, have incredible knife skills, but you put a, you know, a carcass in front of them and they have no idea what to do with it. And you see that on a lot of these cooking shows every time I turn the television on.
You say, oh my, what are they doing to that beautiful piece of meat?
Oh, it can be painful.
Well, does it matter whether the animal has been freshly killed, or do you approach it differently?
Most of the meat that we get is actually not, when you say freshly killed, it won't have been killed that day. The meat that we get has usually been killed on, say, a Monday, and then we'll pick it up on a Thursday. And then we don't even, most of it, we don't actually cut that day. There are certain pieces that are best fresh right away off the animal. But then a lot of it we actually hang and will age for a bit, and that does a couple of different things. It kind of firms up the flesh, which makes it easier to cut, and then it also concentrates the flavor a bit, which we obviously want to be providing the highest quality, most flavorful products at all times. So we do that for a couple different reasons. But obviously our meat has never been frozen by the time it when it hits the counter. So that aging process is a nice addition that we do as a value-added service at the butcher shop.
Well, when we're offered aged steak, for example, has the steak already been cut, or was it aged as part of a larger carcass and then cut when I finally came in to buy it?
Sure, that's a good question. Big misconception in the industry in general. It should be aged. It depends. There's a couple different types of aging. Many listeners might have heard of dry aging and wet aging. We use a dry aging process, and in order to do that, you really have to keep it as a large. It's a subprimal typically, so we're really only aging for an extended period of time, kind of the center of the animal. We can get into a little bit of the anatomy later, but it's basically the loin up through the rib, so kind of the very famous steaks. And the difference in the two aging processes is fairly self-explanatory. The dry aging, we're basically going to rack it in a dry or a humidity and temperature-controlled room. It does get rotated, but we're basically not going to touch it for whatever period that is. In our case, we usually do a four-week dry aging process. Wet aging, it basically gets cut fresh right off of the animal. In this case, you can do smaller cuts and even down to steaks. You usually vacuum seal it, and you will literally let it sit kind of in its own juices for that same type of period in order to age it. There are two totally separate processes. The dry aging process is going to, there's going to be a lot more evaporation and water loss, and with that comes a lot of concentration, so you get a lot more concentrated flavor. There's also natural enzymes within the meat that's going to break it down. It changes the flavor a little bit. You get this very distinct kind of umami dry age flavor that you can't get from very many other things out there, and I don't think that is really achieved at all with the wet aging process. The nice thing about wet aging and why it's prevalent everywhere right now is there's almost no loss. You take it out of the bag and it basically weighs what it did or roughly what it did when you put it in. With dry aging, there's a significant loss, which is why you see a lot higher prices right now in the industry for dry age products.
My guests are Ryan Fibiger, owner and head butcher at Kraft Butchery in Westport, Connecticut, and Sam Garwin, who's a butcher at Kraft, who also works to educate the public about using the whole animal. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate, and we have a call. Came in just in time because I was going to ask about humane slaughter and the like. And Annie, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Leonard.
Annie from Wilton?
Yeah, that's right. How are you?
I'm well. You actually raise beef humanely?
Right. And Ryan does the fabrication for us for our pigs and other animals. We've sent Shetland sheep to him. And I have to say he's just a master. And we have a pig CSA. People get shares of pig, and they just cannot believe how beautifully it's done. But what really matters is that when Ryan gets it, he gives us feedback about the animal's health and how it looks, and he tells us if the organs look good, which they have. and it lets us know that we've been raising the animals properly. So the feedback from him is extraordinary, and it's important that he tell us that.
And, Ryan, what would indicate that there was a problem?
There's a lot of things. You get a much different perspective from the inside of the animal out. So what's nice in talking to farmers like Annie, by the way, who's one of our favorites up at Millstone, is that they get a great perspective of how the animal lived and what it looked like from the outside. But there's a lot of information that you get when that carcass hits our butcher block. So you can really immediately tell if how it was raised, if it was a largely grass-based diet in terms of the color of the fat, in terms of the color of the meat, in terms of the fat consistency, the amount of fat within the meat. But you can also tell if there's been any mistreatment, and some of that mistreatment could have come as it was being raised, and you can kind of tell that if there's any, like, old bruises or injuries or anything like that, up until you can tell if there's an incident that happened at the time of the slaughter. And it really kind of tells you a story by looking at the carcass. And there's also lots of other kind of things you'll see as you begin breaking it down. Once you start looking at the glands, you can see if it was the glands are basically a filter. You can see if the animal had a had disease or was sick. You can see if there's any, you know, any prevalence of tumors or anything like that. So it really does kind of talk to you and tell you a lot about how that animal was raised and how it came to be on our table.
Now, Annie, yesterday we did a segment on some of the agribusinesses that are growing pigs and chickens and meat cows and the like, and most of them are kept in very tight spaces. They're never allowed to graze outside. The pigs often have their tails cut off so they won't eat each other's tails because they go a bit crazy in this confinement. I'm assuming that you allow your animals to roam free?
Yes, they're all pastured, and everybody has tails, and one of them is called Lefty because her tail goes left. And as Brian's seen the farm, and we like people to come and see how the animals are raised. We're not open to the public, but people we work with, like Ryan, and all of our chefs come to the farm, and the people who join the Pig CSA, they're all pastured, even in the winter. They're never confined. When they farrow outdoors. They build their own nest. We provide shelter, of course, and heat lamps when they farrow, but they act like pigs. They root. They're not ringed, and it really adds to the flavor because they're eating those hickory nuts that you talked about earlier, and all of the other things that have fallen, instead of us foraging them, they are.
Now, why aren't more people doing this? Is it so much more expensive?
It requires more land. You know, you can raise 1,000 pigs in a factory building, and that might take up, 1,000 square feet or 2,000 square feet. I can raise maybe 10 pigs in that same space if I'm letting them forage. So, of course, I'm going to raise fewer if they're foraging, because they need a lot of space, because they dig it up and eat everything, and then we have to move them to a new area in the woods or a new pasture, which we reseed then after they've moved on. But so they are all outdoors acting like pigs and being pigs, and they're happy. They're in good shape. One of the things, Ryan, I look for when they go to Ryan is, was the liver okay? And that means they don't have parasites. If the liver is clean, they can't pass the USDA inspection if the liver's bad, and they won't let you have the liver. So if the liver is good and it comes back to the butcher clean, it means they didn't have any parasites. There's no scarring from parasites. And that's the first thing I always ask.
Now, Annie, just one more thing before you go. Oh, you wanted to add something, Ryan?
No, I just wanted to mention that she's spot on with the liver discussion.
Just one more thing before you go. What is humane slaughter and how is it carried out?
Well, Leonard, you and I had dinner with Temple Grandin quite a few years ago at the Blue Hill in New York when she spoke at the 92nd Street Y.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and Temple helped me design a slaughterhouse, and so all of Temple's influence I carry with me. And what it means is the animal is never mistreated, is treated with respect. When we do move them, we move them in a way that doesn't stress them. And it's really about respecting the animal and understanding what a pig needs to be happy and not stressed. And that really is by just providing them with what they'd have if they were out in the wild. Of course, they're not wild pigs. They're domesticated, so we have to provide that.
Thank you so much for calling us. You've really added a lot to the conversation.
Thanks a lot, Leonard. And, Brian, it's great to hear you.
You as well. Thank you, Annie. I would like to add one addition to her comment on the slaughter, and I think I can speak with Annie on this because we've had many, many long discussions on this, is that it is one of the biggest frustrations and sticking points for people who are trying to raise animals like Annie's doing and sell those type of animals like we're doing, is there's a huge hole in the industry right now, which is the slaughter operation, and it's not being done well by the people who are doing it, and they're continuing to disappear. So that there's certainly a void that if we're going to keep growing this thing, it's got to be filled by people who are doing it humanely and who are doing it almost as an art form, like the way we're doing it now.
Is it done closer to the way ritual slaughters are done for kosher and halal meat?
It is in a way, in the sense that it's done it's a much more intricate process. It's done one at a time, and I think that in itself tells a lot about how humane the slaughter actually is. Each individual animal is done one at a time, and these are usually much smaller operations. So we're not talking about big factories where they're doing several thousand in a day. We're talking about they might do 10. And that's my first question when I go into a new operation is, how many are you doing in a day? And what is your capacity? And then I get into more detailed questions on how they're doing it and if it's what I describe as humane after that. But that's kind of where I start.
A listener left a question on our show page. How much should we expect to pay for beef that's raised humanely and fed a healthy diet? For example, how much per pound should a ribeye cost?
I can. That's one of the biggest questions that we get asked, and it's a sensitive one because I want to make sure for this business that we started and. And for this industry that's really flourishing right now to grow in any meaningful way, we really need to make this a product that's available to everyone. So, there are going to be some things because, a steer, for example, will stay with beef, has a limited amount of certain cuts on it, and there's a certain supply and demand out there for those cuts. So the very, what I would call the famous, the popular, the ribeyes, the tenderloins, the strips, the porterhouses, and so on, there's a significant demand for that, particularly in Westport, and it does drive the price up a little bit. But what I'd like to tell people is we pay one price per pound for these animals, and what that allows us to do is, yes, we're getting more money for those cuts, but we have all these incredible cuts that most people haven't even heard of that are comparable, if not better, than all those popular cuts that I just mentioned. So, and at much lower price points. But to answer your question specifically, I think it's probably about a 10 to 15% increase premium over certainly not the lowest end grocery store product, but stuff that would be, at least kind of in the same ballpark to do like more locally, humanely raised, sustainably raised, largely grass-based meat. But once you get into cooking with some of these more unfamiliar cuts and it takes a little bit more thought process, but it can be significantly cheaper. And at the end of the day, it doesn't really have to cost anything more than what people are paying now. And I will add one additional thing to that, then I'll turn it over, is that I think in general, and most people would probably agree, we're eating way too much meat as a country even. And I think that's probably strange for people to hear a butcher who's trying to make money say that, but I think we generally eat way too much meat. So if we can eat less meat and maybe pay a little bit for that meat, I think at the end of the day it kind of balances itself out.
Now, Sam, the other cuts, the less expensive cuts that Ryan was talking about, I assume are the ones that are slightly tougher. You have to cook them a bit longer.
Yeah, that's exactly right. But there's a trade-off there, which is that in general, when you're thinking about a cut of meat, a good rule of thumb is the more a muscle is used throughout the animal's life, the more flavor it's going to have. Now, it's also going to be less tender straight off the animal, but the benefit is that flavor. So, for instance, there's a reason you make pulled pork out of the shoulder of the pig. That muscle is getting used constantly, all day, every day, and so that is really maximal flavor. You put it in a slow cooker, you leave it there for 6-8 hours, and it's going to be incredibly flavorful. And I suppose it requires a little bit more forethought. You have to remember to put that in the morning, but in terms of overall work being done, I actually think that some of the braising cuts or the roasts can be less effort because it's a set it and forget it kind of meal versus, a steak, which takes perhaps less time to cook, but you really need to watch it to make sure you're not going to overcook it or anything like that.
Although some of these become fad meats, short ribs, which used to be really cheap, now are very expensive simply because there's a higher demand for them?
Absolutely, absolutely. Meat has trends just like anything else, and it's actually great to see that there's right now an offal trend going on, so people actually seeking out the odd bits like tongues and pig ears and organ meats and that sort of thing. And I actually think that's wonderful because we should be using all of the animal.
Well, the French do. The French do. In fact, people all over the world do. Americans, perhaps the least.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. We are kind of catching up to the rest of the world in terms of how we're using the whole animal. And you know, at Kraft, we actually we're lucky in that we have customers who are interested in that sort of thing, so we can sell a lot of them to our customers. And then what we're not able to sell to our customers, we actually turn into dog food. So there's always a use for everything.
We have to take a little break. Today's guests on Food Friday are Sam Garwin and Ryan Fibiger of Kraft Butchery in Westport, Connecticut. And our number here is 212-433-9692. You can reach us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And we are back with Ryan Fibiger, owner and head butcher at Kraft Butchery in Westport, Connecticut, and Sam Garwin, a butcher at Kraft. And taking your calls at 212-433-9692. You can write us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And a listener has written in, he's a hunter, and he says, how do you dress meat, skin it, butcher it, so you don't spoil the carcass? In this case, he's thinking about rabbit.
Sure. I mean, the key there is with hunting any game, and I don't have a ton of experience here, but we do a lot of off-site work for some hunters, including, you know, mostly deer. But we've done some rabbit in the past as well, and the key there is the field dressing. The butchering can be done later. Once that animal is down, it needs to be bled first. The whole key is to get the blood out, hopefully while the heart is still beating, and that's key to getting it out as fast as possible, and then it needs to be eviscerated, skinned and eviscerated on the spot.
So, and is that that's to avoid spoilage?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we've had calls from deer hunters who have, you know, will call us and they said, I took a deer, you know, 2 days ago, and, you know, I've got it in my garage. And the first question any of our butchers will ask is, did you bleed it and is it eviscerated? And if the answer is no, we don't touch it because that animal is at this point spoiled and needs to be, unfortunately, it needs to be discarded. But so for a hunter, the most important thing is to understand and learn how to field dress. And not something I'm a professional at by any means, but there's certainly a lot of avenues to get an education on that as well.
Let's take some calls. We have Peter from Park Slope on the line. Hi, Peter.
Hey, how are you? I got a share of a locally raised hog, and I wanted to use the head to make a pate. And I had a really difficult time getting the hair off. You know, I know some people use a torch, but I thought that would affect the taste of the stock. So I tried to scald it, but the hair really only came off in clumps. So I ended up skinning the head, but I lost a lot more fat than I would have liked. What can you tell me what, you know, the proper technique is, the legitimate way of doing that?
Sure. I mean, frankly, that probably should have been done immediately when that animal is first slaughtered, and it's much easier to get that hair off. I assume it was more a heritage breed or probably a black-haired pig. It's much harder to get, which is more like a Berkshire,
yeah,
or something in that range. It's tough to get the hair off, especially if it's not done immediately. Once it comes to us, if it wasn't scalded properly, all of our pigs are scalded when they come to us. It's really difficult. I think you did the right thing. I probably would have skinned it too. Usually you can scald it with hot water, but at that point, I don't think it's worth it. So skinning, it's fine, but you're right. You probably lost. I mean, there's great stuff in that skin that you took off that you probably wanted in that pate, I'm assuming. There's great collagen. There's great flavor. So you probably did lose a little bit there. In the future, if it's coming from a CSA that you use a lot, I would just ask them to make sure that it's completely scalded when it's slaughtered.
Okay, thanks.
Can we butcher at home? I mean, if I have a
Absolutely.
Good knife, if I have a, what would I need, a saw, a knife, a cleaver?
Sure.
A butcher block?
People do it all the time. You know, you need a decent-sized space. you probably really only need, when I do any work, I need a 5-inch boning knife. It doesn't have to be fancy. It just needs to be a fairly stiff blade. That's what we start all of our students on. And then usually you need a meat saw. For some of the bigger animals, you might need one longer scimitar, something like that. But you can pretty much do it you can pretty much break an entire steer down with a 5-inch boning knife. And that's how I learned how to do it, and that's how we teach everyone how to do it. So the tools aren't significant. A meat saw is a little different than a typical hacksaw. Can you do it with a hacksaw? Sure, but it's not going to be quite as clean as doing it with a meat saw with the teeth face forward only. So those are the tools that you need. But we have people who take our classes all the time for purposes of either they're a hunter and they want to break animals down at home, or they want to buy larger shares of animals because they can save a lot of money in doing it. They can buy, half a steer or half a pig, and they can break it down at home. And it's a pretty affordable and economic way of buying meat.
Now, Sam, how do you avoid cutting yourself?
Cut carefully. Definitely, know when you're tired. When we start off learning, we have chainmail aprons, which are exactly what they sound like. They're very heavy, and we definitely encourage the new students wear those. If you're going to be breaking beef especially, it requires a lot of force. So in addition to knowing where to cut, you have to frequently, put your body weight behind it, and that's when injuries can happen, the serious kinds of injuries. Everyone gets nicks occasionally on their hands. That's unavoidable. And then we also actually, in the shop, and people at home wouldn't have this, but we use a bandsaw for cutting really big pieces, and that's probably the scariest, most dangerous part of the job is that bandsaw. But, we take all the precautions, so far, so good.
A listener wondered why kosher meat is more expensive.
Yeah, I mean, kosher meat has a very particular slaughter process, and then you also are working with a rabbi to bless it and do all of the things that it needs to be certified kosher. So whenever you add an extra step to any supply chain, you're going to have additional cost added on to that. Just like for our slaughterhouses, there has to be a USDA inspector there at all times, and so you're paying his salary when you're buying meat from us. It all adds up in the course of a supply chain.
Simon from Madison, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. I have a question about breakfast bacon. In England, we found that breakfast bacon has lots of meat and very little fat. But in the U.S., it seems to be totally the opposite. And I wondered, is it the way the animal is raised, or is it a particular cut of meat, or a combination of both?
Yeah, it's probably a little both, but it's mostly the latter. It's typically a different cut. And one thing we found since the day that we opened, we didn't anticipate it, but maybe we should have, is one of our biggest groups of customers is mostly British as well as South American. So we had, since the day we opened our doors, we had this huge customer base, and many of them asking about what they consider to be bacon. So most of that's going to be in England anyway. It's rashers, and how a rasher is different than what Americans call bacon. It's a different cut. So a rasher or a British-style bacon is typically more like what you would see as Canadian bacon, which is typically just the loin, which is very lean. It's got some fat on the outside. A rasher, you're going to leave a little bit of the belly on that loin, so you're going to have kind of a tail of a little bit of fat. But you're right. It's definitely a leaner cut of bacon. American bacon is raised to be very fatty. So it's a different cut. It's the belly. And a lot of these pigs that are raised for bacon because they have a gigantic, fatty belly, which for me gets me, as you might be able to tell, gets me very excited. It's pretty awesome to see, and I love both types of bacon, but I really love the fatty belly bacon.
Well, there are many,
but there are many
other styles of bacon. I live in Greenpoint, where we have a local Polish butcher who smokes his own bacon. He asks you if you want single smoke or double smoked. And it's kind of like American bacon, but it isn't again.
Yeah, once you get into that, I mean, you can process it in so many different ways in terms of how long do you cure it. Almost all the bacon is cured. What do you use in your cure? Are you using just salt? Are you using, sugars and aromatics? Are you using nitrates, which make it that, big pink color you see at the grocery store? Are you, you know, how long are you smoking it? Are you smoking more than once? What type of wood are you smoking it with? Like, you can literally go crazy with the combinations to do bacon. Different cuts with different processing gets you, you know, infinite possibilities.
We have very little time, but I wanted to sneak Bob in from Park Slope. Bob, can you make it quick?
Sure. Trichinosis, which was very prevalent before pigs were raised commercially on cement slabs, from what I've read, is almost totally eliminated. When you put pigs out to pasture where they have access to forage, not only on grains but animals that die that may have trichinella, you're raising the risk, and especially in light of people taking the cooking well done less seriously and even recommendations that lower the heat that you should cook pork to. What's the current thinking on pasture-raised pork and trichinella?
Sure. I mean, trichinosis, you're right, is pretty much gone. Most of the people who are, I'll say this, we never worry about it. We never had an issue with it because of the type of farms that we have raising for us. The pastures are, as Annie said earlier, the pastures are large because of the number of animals, but they're very well maintained, and the farmers typically know exactly what's going on in that pasture down to the type of alfalfa or the type of grass that they're growing. So it's very unlikely that they're really consuming any other kind of dead animal matter. That being said, you're right, that's kind of how that disease was spread to begin with. So, you know, there might be a slight uptick in the concern if there's a switch to, you know, complete pasture-raised pork products, but I really don't think it's a concern.
I've heard that there's
concerned about.
That trichinosis has not been an issue for many years in this country. But we've run out of time. My great thanks to our two guests today on Please Explain, Ryan Fibiger, owner and head butcher at Kraft Butchery in Westport, Connecticut, and Sam Garwin, a butcher at Kraft, who also works to educate the public about using the whole animal. It's been a lot of fun talking with you. Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Leonard.
Thank you.